VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I thank you for joining us. Now, you may be wondering, what's going on? I wanted Gab and Natalie, not one or the other. I want both. And you're right. You can have it all. However, Natalie's entitled to her holiday time, and sometimes I'm not here, and sometimes she's not there, and I'm not going to be here on Thursday either. I'll be in Monaco for the Champions League draw, so you'll have Natalie all to yourself. But hopefully, I don't want to get ahead of myself. Hopefully, a week from today, we will both be here, both in the studio. So start getting excited for that. Incidentally, our Predictions League is ongoing. And I'll tell you what, I won't reveal who's ahead. Allison. Yes, that's right. Allison Rudd joins us today. But it's a wafer-thin margin.
I'm trembling with excitement.
Or I always think back to the Monty Python film, wafer-thin. Anyway, joining us later from the Sunday Times, it's everybody's second favorite shaven-headed Scottish football journalist. It's Jonathan Northcroft. The other one, in case you're wondering, lives in South Africa. And this is awesome because it's my second Duncan Castles reference 2 weeks running. That's pretty good. Lots to discuss this week, including Roman Abramovich and Michael Owen. But we start with a congested German. Allison, so Arsenal play West Ham, and it's one of those stories which kind of, sort of there's a story before the story, because can you just describe us? You were there. Just tell us about your day, because I'm assuming on your way over, you heard, oh, look, or when the lineups came out, you heard, oh, look, Ozil isn't in the squad for the day. Goodness me, what must have happened?
Yes, and rumours were flying that there had been a, open quotes, training ground bust up, close quotes. And that
rumors, I might add, reported by João Costello Branco, who is who works for ESPN Brazil, and who I believe stands by his story that there was a bust up, and then when Ozil later, which may or may not have been related to the fact that Ozil later found out he wasn't starting, and then he suddenly got ill. So that's his version of events, but take it from there, because that might not correspond to reality.
Yeah, well, what you have is a main press conference in which that question is asked. Can you explain to the manager is asked, Emery is asked, was there a training ground bust-up? And he says, no, absolutely not. He's not well, he has Qatar, which is being bunged up, Qatar. But then that raised more questions. So when the journalists who write for the Monday papers got into the little padded cell that they have at the Emirates for such discussions, we pointed out this was slightly peculiar. If you have a player who is unwell with something that sounds like a cold or a virus, why did you ask him to come to the ground on the day of the match? And in fact, he spent an hour in the dressing room with the players before the game, which doesn't seem a logical thing to do for someone who's being bunged up. He might spread germs.
Maybe he was hoping to inoculate them and build up the team's immunity.
He didn't give that as the reason, strangely enough. And there's the added little quirk that Arsenal have opened up their new training medical facility that they were showing off to a few journalists, which has lots of signs everywhere saying, you know, beware germs, do not shake hands, stuff like this. So it seemed counterintuitive to have a player with possibly a cold, something worse, mingling with your players. So first of all, Emery said, well, if my other players become ill, that's on me. Which he didn't actually say don't worry, he's not really ill. But it kind of implies that, doesn't it? He sort of smilingly said, you know, if people get ill, you know, it's my fault, it's my fault. He doesn't really expect there to be an illness spreading issue here, which does raise doubts as to how unwell Özil is and whether it's a convenient illness because he didn't like the way he was treated or spoken to at training on Thursday. And then Emery decided he would go into more detail, which again was interesting. And he gave us a timeline, which was that the illness happened at the same time as he started to discuss maybe tactically changing the way Özil played. Emery didn't say, I was going to drop him. He didn't say that. But he did indicate he was perhaps thinking of dropping him from playing number 10 or just using him in a different way or asking him to do more. That was the implication.
Sorry if I jump in. Did he actually say he started getting sick when I discussed his new role, which might involve him being...
Well, clearly I'm paraphrasing. He didn't say that. I'll tell you exactly what he said. He said, 2 days ago, I spoke with him about things tactically for this match and the last match. And he said to me he was sick 2 days ago. Yesterday, Friday, after my conversation on Thursday, he continued to stay off sick. We spoke with the doctor and decided it was better for him to stay at home than if today, if he was feeling better, he should come. So the fact that he says, 2 days ago, I spoke to him tactically about things tactically, and 2 days ago, he said he was sick. I mean, you know, if you want to push it, you can say that's throwing him under the bus a bit. He's not really spreading the idea that his player was genuinely ill. He's allowing us to know that his player, Özil, felt unwell at roughly the same time he was being told you might not be playing number 10.
So I'll explain why this is relevant or maybe not relevant for those who don't know how the reporting process works. Now, there are some managers who like sort of speaking in riddles and dropping hints between the lines. And they do this all the time. We can all imagine who they are. There are other managers who are kind of, you know, plain vanilla when they speak, and they just kind of give you a sequence of events. Emery hasn't been in this country long enough, I think, to build up a relationship with the media where it's easy for the media to say, oh, yeah, Emery's throwing him under the bus, the way Allison said, because otherwise he wouldn't have... because otherwise he wouldn't have used that language and that sequence. Or he may just kind of, you know, slightly robotically saying, like, this is the timeline of what happened and, you know, there's no connection between the two, or you know, I see no connection between the two. Now, this is a bit of a communication problem because it's not really clear, right?
No, I agree completely, of course. You can read that to mean simply it's somebody just being honest and explaining what happened. But right. The fact that he invited the player into the dressing room for an hour, that and the timeline implies that he really, really doesn't sound like he's so ill he couldn't play.
Okay, now, I know for a fact football clubs employ comms people who then go and clarify things and brief journalists and say, look, this is what he said. Just for the avoidance of doubt, this is what he meant. Did anybody come and say, listen, you guys might be getting the wrong spin here, but, you know, he was just giving you the facts. He's not... There's nothing to read between the lines there. Did that happen?
No, the only interjection was there was some concern that the journalists were assuming that Özil had a virus, which made it sound like he was very ill and therefore might have infected the whole squad and they'd have to abandon the game against Cardiff. His demeanour is very impressive. He was very calm and smiley and polite and gave the impression of really trying to help and clarify what had happened. He wasn't.
Nobody figured out.
It didn't feel like he was playing games.
Nasty tabloids and those nasty gutter reporters might go and take this the wrong way. And I want to move it on to Özil himself, because Henry Winter, a colleague, and I haven't actually read the column yet, but I have an idea. He's going to be writing about this, and he's going to point out that we should be careful not to rush to judgment on Mesut Özil because he's been through a ton in the last 3 or 4 months. This is where I become unkind and say, like, yeah, one thing he's been through is that he signed a new contract, making him the highest paid player in the history of Arsenal. No, but obviously he had the absolute nightmare at the World Cup with Germany when they got bounced out in the group stage. He had the whole business with Erdogan. where, you know, he met with him. A lot of people in Germany felt that was inappropriate. He defended it, and talking about his legitimately, I think, his the fact that his heritage is Turkish, but he's German, and, you know, increasingly that's not really a novel thing in the modern world. And then he also got a ton of abuse online. I think his attachment to Germany got and to sort of his loyalty to the country was questioned, and that's all very hurtful. And that, you know, we don't know what's going on with his head, and there's a lot weighing on him. Some Arsenal fans speculating that maybe he's just stressed. How should we approach these situations from a media perspective? Should we just stop making a big deal out of it and just take Emery at face value?
I think it's reasonable to just list what you've listed as to why his state of mind might not be in the best place. But for as long as they're putting out that he had Qatar and not that he was depressed, then you can't speculate that that's why depression. He missed the game.
Okay, I know. But I know we've made strides in terms of the way we view mental health issues and depression. You know, a lot of people have been very open about this, you know, Danny Rose. But could that also be a way of protecting him? Because if they come out and say, oh, Ozil is depressed, you're going to have, you know, the usual, you know, wallies in the media going out like, oh, what's he depressed about? He's so rich. He's depressed counting his money in his World Cup. That is kind of the stupid knee-jerk reaction that we sometimes get in some quarters. Some footballers to this day aren't comfortable in admitting to things like depression and insecurity, right?
Yeah. But
we can't force them to do it.
But equally, we can't decide that's what's going on here without any briefing or off-the-record briefing to guide us in that direction.
Now this season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every single goal from every single game in the Premier League. And guess what? It's just £8 for an 8-week trial. Now, there's a big story in our sister paper, the Sunday Times, that you might have seen. Basically, the story makes a point that Roman Abramovich is now actively planning to sell Chelsea Football Club. Part of it is he's retained the services of a group called Rain, which is Rain is kind of the new Spectre. It's a bunch of Bond villains, actually. No, just kidding. Rain advises people in M&As, basically, and among other things. And they were involved in the sale of a minority stake of Manchester City to the Chinese consortium. That you may recall a few years ago. And joining us to talk about it is Jonathan Northcroft. Johnny, is this kind of Abramovich saying, hey, look, let me just put this out because in case somebody wants to come along and give me a lot of money, I'll be ready?
Yeah, actually, Gab, I think that might be a fair reading of it, because one of the significant things from our business team's point of view who produced the story was that when they went to Chelsea, they didn't get a denial. They didn't even get a response. And then I think since publishing the story, there's been very little response. No on-the-record denials from Chelsea at all, and there hasn't been a response to the paper. And I think you kind of experienced business reporters take that as a sort of tacit signal that, at the very least, it's not a story that the person you've written about is unhappy to see in the public domain. So if they are searching for interest to buy the whole club or a stake in the club, a story like that, I guess, doesn't do them any harm whatsoever, because it sort of floats the idea of selling and it sees what interest there is out there. I think the significant details that were in the story were that of the Rain investment bank that had been hired to sort of drum up a sale or a sale of a stake or whatever, and the fact that Silver Lake Partners, who are quite significant private equity firm, had tried to buy a bit of Chelsea, had been rebuffed, but had been in dialogue with the club, which I think suggests that there's a feeling that Chelsea's viable. But, you know, I think club takeovers or club sales are even more opaque than big transfers, in my experience. And I wouldn't expect Chelsea to do much on the record about this.
I think I have to point out that a club source said and wanted it to be known to the papers that the club is not for sale. They've made that clear. I think we have
Ali, but they what they didn't want to do was on the record say that. You know, so there are degrees of denial I think. But yeah, I take the point.
This idea that Abramovich wants to sell, again, for those who don't know the background story, he's owned the club since 2003. There's several things pointing in that direction, right, I suppose. So one is Chelsea were supposed to build this giant 60,000-seat stadium. That project has been... And is it officially abandoned or simply in perpetual hold now?
No, I mean, in fact, I think the Mail have got a story today that, you know, it's very, very vague, but it says that... That you know, Chelsea staff have been told that work's going to restart on it. Although actually, nothing's actually been built, but planning work is going to restart, whatever that means. So I think Chelsea are still trying to put out that there is, you know, there is a project.
I suppose a big thing in these is getting sort of planning, especially in that part of London, getting planning permission, getting the architect. I mean, they have the design, they have everything, they just haven't. Mm-hmm. Started building the darn thing. So that, I suppose, is value in and of itself. The other big factor, of course, is the relationship between the British government and the Russian government. Again, for those who don't know, Roman Abramovich is Russian. He also has an Israeli passport. For Russians to work in the United Kingdom, you need some sort of visa. He had a visa and a work permit that allowed him to work here, and that was revoked. I don't know if anybody said this, but there's obviously a lot of suggestions that it has to do with the tensions between Russia and the United Kingdom, and the poisoning of the Russian dissident, with Russia having been accused of being involved. Long story short, this guy does not get his work permit renewed. He can still visit the country with his Israeli passport, but he's not allowed to work here. So the thinking is that all these factors put together make him say, oh, you know what? I've had a good run with Chelsea. The club's worth a lot more than the $140 million plus debt that I paid to go and buy it. Let me just sell and go do something else with my time. And in fact, we have a story on the back page today, Matt Hughes again saying that Abramovich would really only consider selling if he was offered an enormous sum. He's talking £2.5 billion, which off the top of my head is about three times as much as the most expensive sale ever.
So I mean but that's actually saying it's for sale, isn't it? Really, you know, it's saying it's not for sale, but it would be at a big price. I think there is a sense that Chelsea are at a sort of turning point or a watershed moment. Part of that is the stadium, because if it's Abramovich or someone else that's going to take over that project, it's going to cost at least $1 billion. You know, that's at the outset, and in everyone's experience, stadiums tend to end up costing, you know, one and a half or double what you think they're going to cost. So at least $1 billion, going to take 5 years. You're looking at, you know, Manchester City are about to celebrate their 10th anniversary of Abu Dhabi ownership. The money stream does not seem to have any sign of stopping there. You know, they're only part of the way on a journey that you can see them on to become at the center of this cluster of worldwide clubs, the most powerful thing in football. Manchester United, their share price is at an all-time high. They've never been more valued in the market. They maybe aren't doing brilliantly on the pitch, but they're still spending a huge amount of money on wages, on transfers. You've got Liverpool, who they've broken two transfer records this season. They might not quite have the same amount of money, but they're very, very smart with how they use it. And then you've got what's happening in Europe with the powerhouse clubs there. So there is a sense that how are Chelsea going to compete and stay Chelsea, as it were, stay one of the major players in Europe against this backdrop? You've even got Spurs building a new stadium, so even within London, there's a challenge to them. So whether it is Abramovich or someone else, that there's going to have to be another sort of round of pretty huge investment, I would suggest, to keep Chelsea where they've been for the last 10 years. And this is a guy that's already put £1 billion into his football club. At the very least, he's looking for investment, we now know. He's hired Rein. And as you suggest, if somebody wants to give him £2.5 billion, which is a profit of £2 billion at least, nobody knows what Abramovich thinks. But logically, there's a lot of reasons why he would sell.
Now, Chelsea played Newcastle on Sunday. They won away 2-1. It's three wins from three for Chelsea. Newcastle set up uber defensively, and there's a strong argument to be made that, you know, John Joe Shelby and Lascelles and a bunch of other guys weren't there, and, you know, he really had no option to go and do that, and poor Rafa and Mike Ashley so mean and whatever. by the same token, Maurizio Sarri, who obviously replaced Rafa at Napoli, he said, it's weird. I'd never seen him go and play like this in Italy, although I think people over here have seen, know that Rafa can go uber defensive. Just conceptually, is this the right way to play? In the sense that it strikes me that if you line up like that and you go a goal down, then, it wasn't the case here, but you're generally toast at that point.
To convince the team that they should play five at the back and get that many people behind the ball, and to have poor old Rondon trying to feed off scraps that he never quite got to, but kept trying, 95% of the time it was very disciplined performance. That is not easy. I know he's doing it because he's, in a way, he's scared of the threat of Chelsea, that, you know, if you've got Eden Hazard in a team, you've got to think they're better than us. We've just got to play to what we can do here. But to convince a team that they should play like that at home and have that level of concentration for most of the game, although there were lots of stories in the build-up to the kick-off that he'd fallen out with several players, which we've all been denied, and players left out are apparently injured and not in a strop. What you manage to get out of those players proves that there is respect from them to their manager. This was not done unwillingly. And there were no boos. It got very, very quiet. There was no jeering. I think that there's a degree of bravery and indeed talent, although it's a strange one, to doing that.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This makes for actually for a good transition, Jonathan, since you were at the Wolves game when they hosted City, because they also lined up, correct me if I'm wrong, with sort of three center backs and sort of two full backs and whatever. But the difference is they had a lot of pace up front, and they had two midfielders, which, you know, he doesn't have, like Moutinho, who maybe older now, but obviously can still pass and is very experienced, and Neves, who's a very good player, who can provide some relief, because when they win the ball back, they can actually keep it a little bit. They can be more incisive with their passing than, you know, certainly more so than, no disrespect, Key and Yame, who were Rafa's equivalents. Did Wolves deserve their point in your opinion?
Yeah, I thought they were terrific, and what they also did on top of that was they applied a really fierce high press against City, as well as anyone I've seen do it outside of Liverpool. Actually, I mean, they really,
which Newcastle most definitely did not do.
They didn't do that, and I mean the effort, the determination of Jota and Helder Costa in the wide areas was fantastic to apply that. But as you say, Gab, one of the keys in doing that is having two absolutely superb midfielders who, when they do get the ball, to actually dictate the game and make the right passes to release people on the break. So they were very, very good at doing that. I thought they played very smart. They played in phases. There were long periods when City were ascendant, but they played in sort of 10, 15-minute bursts where, you know, almost sort of, you know, like in rowing, just went to sort of full speed, full stroke for 15 minutes and had City under pressure. I thought they were really interesting tactically, some really interesting players and Molyneux, you know, which just reminded you what a great place that is to watch football, what a great atmosphere they can conjure there. And I went away thinking, I already enjoy watching Manchester City and always look forward to them, but there's another team I'm now going to really look out for the fixtures and hope I get them, because Wolves are going to be doing some great things on the pitch. But I think they'll be fine, and I think they'll be really good to watch this year.
I wasn't watching there. I was watching on telly at the Emirates, and I felt it was a landmark moment and might actually dictate the way the season goes, because Wolves showed that if you pick the right line to hold against City, I mean, this is now the template. Gab spoke a lot last season about where is the template to play against City, and it was as if, other than Liverpool, nobody could quite work it out. And very early in the season, we have a team, they play deep, but not so deep that they can't counter-attack. It's having the bravery to know what your strengths are, what that line is, so that when you do have the ability to counter-attack, you can really hurt them. And City seemed a bit flummoxed by that bravery, I thought. Did you feel that? But Jonathan, did you feel like this might... It's not just Wolves I'm impressed by. This might mean City have a lot of trouble this season.
Yeah, I felt exactly that. That maybe, you know, it's one thing seeing Liverpool do it, but seeing a, let's say, quote-unquote smaller team being able to do it might just set a trend. But one thing Nuno Espirito Santo did say afterwards about the press and the way they applied it was, you know, he said it takes a lot of practice to do that, and he made the point that, you know, they're working from 9 till 5 in training at Wolves. They do afternoon sessions as well, and he did say it takes a lot of patience and a lot of work to get to this point. And he also said, we're going to play like that against everybody. You know, we have an identity, and we're going to not just do it against City, which is also quite interesting. So I think you can do it against them, but the work that is required, and then probably the quality of midfielder as well to really make it all sort of come together, is maybe not something that everyone is able to do.
Before we pronounce the death of City, maybe also worth mentioning that, correct me if I'm wrong, they did hit the woodwork twice. Yes, Jonathan?
Yeah.
Wolves' goal was a handball, and had the referee seen it, he would have disallowed it.
Why would he have disallowed it? Wasn't intentional. If a defender had thwacked a clearance against him and it had gone in off his shoulder, that would have been a goal.
Not if it had gone in off his arm, though.
It's not actually illegal.
No, it is.
It's not in the laws of the game.
Maybe not in the laws of the game, it's those not in the laws of the things, game. But maybe in the directives that go with it and the explanation of the laws of the game, which FIFA publish.
If you accept it's completely accidental, it's not a foul. It's not a free kick. Therefore, it's a goal.
It does go back to the intentionality thing, doesn't it? I felt that as well, that, you know, it's hard to know whether it's deliberate or not, but I do think that having his arm in that position, you can't really get inside his mind and ask why his arm's there, stretched out like it was. But I think it's difficult to see refs allowing that. Yeah.
I mean, it's simple. You gain an advantage, whether it's intentional or not. And look, I made this point last year with the Doucouré handball. I kind of find this kind of grotesque. I don't know if Doucouré's was intentional or not. I don't know if this one was. But the point is, you're not allowed to score goals with your hand in football. You gain an unfair advantage from doing it. And just as last year, I said, you know what? I think we should create a climate where you expect Doucouré to actually say, you know what? That ball came off my hand. Because he knows that the ball came off his hand, even though if nobody else did. In the same way, Boly, presumably, knows that the ball came off his hand.
But you're applying moral judgment. Gab, do you accept that if a defender made an absolute hash of a clearance from his goal line and it hit an onrushing centre-forward who was just running normally and it went in off his bicep as he was running in and the ball went in the net, that the referee should disallow that?
Yes.
Why?
It doesn't matter because you're not allowed to. It's called football for a reason. You're not allowed to go and score.
The ball hits your arms all the time in football. Every time that happens, it's not a foul or a free kick.
I'm not suggesting it's a foul. I'm just saying you can't score that way. You should not be able to score that way.
Okay, it's pretty nailed on. That is your interpretation of modern football. That is not written in the laws anywhere.
If you score a goal with your arm and you know that the ball came off your arm, whether it was intentional or accidental, you should say the ball hit my arm, because everybody can see that the ball hit your arm. And if people don't do that, and obviously they shouldn't do it in Boldy's case because that's a different situation, but going forward, you should just say, look, if this happens and you don't say, look, the ball came off my arm, then there should be a ban. I mean, I think I don't see what there is to go and debate about this.
Well, the debate is there needs to be.
So we don't need to worry about whether it's intention.
Any ball crossing the line because it hit an arm is disallowed.
You gain an advantage. Before Wolves fans get all excited, I made the exact same point about Doucouré last year, and incidentally, that decision, that unseen handball, ended up probably costing Mauricio Pellegrino his job and left Southampton in danger of going down to the end of the season. So these decisions do end up having consequences. So we'll move on now to Michael Owen, because sometimes you get those moments of great TV that get shared virally. He was speaking on Premier League Tonight on BT Sport on Saturday, and for those who are too young to know, Michael Owen was a sensation at 17 and 18 for Liverpool, was very prolific, then went to Real Madrid, then came back, and then his career took a really downwards turn, and he attracted a lot of criticism. And he had this to say about how injuries affected him later on.
Mentally, I could do it, but physically,
it's just horrible to still want to do it, but just your body just simply doesn't let you.
And you know what's even worse is that I explained how it felt when someone like Maka got the ball, and my immediate reaction is do this, and then split second is no, you can't, just go short. The worst thing is you then get into a rut whereby you don't even put yourself in a position to be able to run. So you actually then go and stand in areas where you shouldn't even be.
Alan Shearer retweeted this, and as you can imagine, Alan Shearer, not a fan, and then of this attitude. And there's also a lot of Newcastle fans upset by this, because he's basically saying that, you know, he effectively hid later in his career. What I find surprising is that you would think that if you work and you train with somebody every day, and you've got, you know, sports psychologists there and coaches and medical staff, and, you know, Owen also sort of argues about how because his hamstring had snapped earlier, there was some kind of imbalance and whatever else, that people would know this and say, look, this guy clearly can't play. His head isn't right. He's not doing what we ask of him. I mean, by his own admission there, he was never playing on the shoulder, because if he did that, then people would expect him to sprint. How does it get to this?
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. I feel close to this because I was the first person to interview Michael Owen in this country ever. First newspaper interview with Michael Owen. And he was, okay, he was young, but he was excited and he spoke in a certain way. Just so excited to be at Liverpool. And you know, sometimes you speak to someone, the joy of their life is just evident in the way they speak. And then the next time I spoke to him, he'd had a couple of problems with his hamstring, and I feel terrible now. And I said to him, do you feel scared every time you play? Is it a weight on your shoulder? Is it a niggle in the back of your head that, oh my God, my hamstring might go? And does that stop you giving it your full pelt on the football field? And his eyes clouded over. He was a completely different person. No, not at all. I'm tired of talking about my hamstring. That is not, you know, that's not an issue. It doesn't cross my mind. Because you're talking, Gavs, about, you know, sports psychologists. We're still talking about an era where people did not admit their fears. And if you can't admit it's an issue, you can't redesign your game. So he was still trying to be the old Michael Owen. So he didn't ask for help. And whilst he was still okay as a footballer, people are lazy ultimately, and they know what he could do. So every time he got signed, people assumed, oh, well, here, he'll be happy and he'll be the old Michael Owen. So there was, I think there was stupidity involved. I think there was laziness involved. Laziness involved. But if the player is scared to come clean, I feel really sorry for him now, because if he'd faced up to the implications of the hamstring issues earlier, he could have made himself a slightly different player. He could have learned new tricks rather than avoiding his old tricks, which is what he sounds like he was doing.
I mean,
it's a sad story.
So first of all, I mean, I'm extremely grateful to Michael Owen for being so brutally honest. And you can say it's easy to be honest now, but, you know, he still has an image. And certainly the reaction, especially from Newcastle fans, because you'll recall, and this is part of the reason why, you know, Alan Shearer took this so personally, and I fully understand why he did. That was a season that Newcastle went down, and he didn't play on the last day of the season. And there's a guy named Paul Ferris, who was a former Newcastle player who got injured early on, then he became a physio. He was a physio at the club. Somebody sent me pages from his book, which I was unfamiliar with, where he sort of describes, and obviously this is Ferris's version of events, him talking to Michael Owen before that final game and saying, well, the scan shows you're fine. And Owen says, no, I got a niggle. You know, I probably shouldn't play the last game of the season. And then according to Ferris, again, this is Ferris's account in his book, Owen says, well, you know, I'm out of contract. You know, I can't have a hamstring injury now. And Ferris saying, well, you have a contract and it's with us. And I don't know. I think it's one of those things where, as a journalist, I'm very grateful for him being so honest. But by the same token, I don't think this is appropriate behavior from a professional while he was playing. By the same token, though, players will do what they get away with. And I wonder, it just seems to me that there were so many people around him who were clearly enabling this. Because, you know, what he said about, like, sort of the three hamstring muscles and one of them snaps. And we have medicine. We have scans that can go and establish this. We have people who watch him every day, right? It's pretty simple. If he's saying, well, I was never going on the shoulder last defender so that, you know, people wouldn't notice that I wasn't sprinting, so I was sitting deeper and whatever. I just find it extraordinary that here he is, he's making an enormous amount of money. And again, with all the sympathy in the world for his condition, but then nobody picks up on it to the point that they feel the need to either put their foot down or to help him. You know, all we get is this stuff at a distance. Oh, look, Owen's not himself anymore. And people were saying, like, we lost his love of the game and the horses and all this other nonsense. When in fact, according to Owen, the reason was he just didn't want to get hurt again.
I've read the whole of the Ferris book, and it's astonishing that it's being tweeted out, because what that book tells you is just how rubbish physios and analysis of players was during his time as a physio at the club. He's a big, big mate of Alan Shearer, so he sees everything through the prism of that. He loves the man. It's a very good book, by the way. Very, very good book, by the way. But it has an agenda, and the author adores Alan Shearer and wouldn't have a word said against his management or the way he handled things at the club. And he went through a terrible time himself, the author of that book, with injuries, being misdiagnosed and being told to get up off your feet and keep trying and that sort of thing. And he says he eventually became a physio to try and help people. The irony of then feeling that Michael Owen was putting, you know, his future contract ahead of the club is ridiculous. It's horrible when you earn your living from your body and your body doesn't do what you want it to do, but you've got a reputation and image. I feel huge sympathy.
Right, time now to find out how Natalie and I fared in our predictions league. Week one, you may recall, I was victorious, just, and only because of Kennedy's penalty, for which I'm very, very grateful. Obrigado, Kennedy. This weekend, Natalie went for Arsenal to beat West Ham. I went for a draw, so that's 1-0 Natalie. Natalie plumped for Everton to win at Bournemouth. I again went for a draw, and I was correct this time, so it was 1-1. Dipping down into League Two, I thought Exeter, given their top of the table, would win at MK Dons on Saturday. But Natalie correctly predicted that Paul Tisdale's new club would beat his old club 2-1, Natalie. On to Sunday, and I thought Fulham would register their first win of the season against Burnley. Natalie went for the draw. Not enough faith in my man Djokanovic. So I was right again, 2-2. Now, we both had Real Madrid winning at Girona, so it came down to whether either of us could guess the correct scoreline. Natalie went for 2-1, I went for 3-1, it finished 4-1. I mean, this week it's a draw between Natalie and I, although, to be fair, I really should get the points for the Real Madrid game, given that it was 3-1 really until the end, and I was closer to the final 4-1 scoreline. But hey, what matters is that I'm in the lead 1-0. It's all about these fine margins. Now, how about some quick hits? Liverpool win again. It's 3 wins, 3 clean sheets, 3 unchanged lineups. Alison, is everything great? Or are you going to find things to nitpick?
What's the opposite of nitpick? Sitting here with a big smile on my face, feeling very smug indeed. I'm not going to nitpick because everything's perfect. Liverpool have even hired, for exclusive use, the world's best exponent of the long throw. They are leaving no stone unturned. They are turning into the perfect football club.
And your namesake made some fine saves as well. Everton are held at Bournemouth 2-2, 2 red cards, but the Richarlison one, I don't know. Here we go into referees again, Alison. Hear me out. I thought it was a little harsh. I realize 2 guys square off. One guy, it's not like he headbutted him, he put his head forward. And only one of them gets sent off. Should the referee just have sent them both off and just make a rule?
I think most fans, most people who love football would have really preferred both players to just get a yellow card for being silly.
Or that.
There was
too,
nothing
yeah.
violent going on. And I think this is a case of, you know, like language, weird words get into the OED eventually because they're used often enough. In this case, there's enough will around the world of football for the laws to be adapted or some guidance to go out to say, just putting your forehead down a tiny touch just to show tiny bit of irritation with someone glaring at you is a booking in the first instance if there's no violence. It's becoming minuscule, the point at which it could be interpreted as violent conduct. It's ridiculous.
Watford beat Crystal Palace 2-1, and guess what? They're also joint top of the table. 3 wins from 3. Alison, are you going to show them some love, and especially my man Javi Gracia? Or will you complain about Doucouré's stamp and how Zaha was hard done by and poor old Roy?
Watford do deserve love. I thought they fizzled out at the end of the season. Lost Richarlison, I thought they'd struggle, and instead holding on to Doucouré seems to be much more important for them, and their team spirit is a star. But Zaha was muted for a lot of the game. Capu should, I think, have been sent off for a violent, dangerous tackle on the back of his leg. It was horrible. And all that whole Harry the Hornet build-up, I think Roy might have stoked the wrong fire there because there was a bit of a sort of pantomime villain thing going on every time Zaha was touched or near the ball or touched anyone else. And if you'd rewound and that had been a red card, I think it would have been a very different outcome.
Fulham, your local club, finally come together to bang 4 goals past Burnley. Now, again, you can either celebrate the many new faces at the Cottage who are all finally coming together, or you can worry about how Burnley and Sean Dyche, last year so strong on the road, can give up 4 in 1 go.
I'm so bored by what the Europa League does to teams when they try so hard to get there. I'm not going to even discuss that and instead say,
sorry, Sean.
Yippee, because Fulham, they were without a win. People were doubting that spending £100 million, that could be the wrong thing to do. And had, you know, you've got to integrate new faces slowly. Well, Slavisa Djukanovic is a manager who anyway rotates. He's always dropping players. You're surprised he's dropped them. He'll rotate his keepers. He just loves mixing things up. And so, in a sense, you could argue that someone who does that anyway can cope with an influx of new faces. And they have been playing increasingly better and fully deserved their win. There could be some real stars of the Premier League at Craven Cottage this season. Gab, I have a question for you. You wrote about Paris Saint-Germain in today's game, but why haven't they been punished yet for violating financial fair play?
Well, I think we'll get a decision soon. The violation or the breach, if it happened, was for the Neymar Mbappe deals, and that accounting period only ended on June 30th, 2018. So under the old financial fair play method, they would have been audited or notified that they were being audited like in September, October, and then we would have had a decision in April and it would only have been enforced from next season. Now the new one, they can basically be punished at any time. The idea is to look at the present. And with this in mind, it's quite remarkable what they've done because they have a tiny squad. They have a bunch of 19-year-olds. You know, some of them are good, some of them not so much. And they've already raised something like $60 million in sales, and hopefully they might even top the $100 million mark this summer if they sell Gonzalo Guedes and Jesse, who have not been involved in going on the preseason tour, very much for sale. They're kind of acting as if they're already being punished by being thrifty and whatever else. It'll be interesting to see how this pans out this year because there's very, very little depth beyond the starting 11. On the other hand, you can also look at it and say
hey, isn't it great? One of the byproducts of FFP is that all these kids are being given a chance to play.
Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many thanks to my excellent guests, Alison Rudd, and the wonderfully shaven-headed Jonathan Northcroft. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone, too, for only £8 for 8 weeks. That's £8 for 8 weeks. Quite the deal. Search The Times subscription for more information. Natalie will be back on Thursday with a look ahead to the Champions League season.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.